So we have our questions.
Yes. Lev Sutra, which is chanted, is that a direct translation of the sutras?
Yeah. Yes, it's a direct translation of the Metta Sutta, which is in the Sutta Nipata. Direct translation. So there we go. And that was the chant that the Burmese monks chanted down the streets during the Saffron Revolution, where the guns of the soldiers pointed at them. They just chanted that. Just may all beings be happy and well, too. And all those people just could pull the trigger any time. It's a very powerful chant. So next time you're in a demonstration in Australia and the army have got the guns trained at you. We don't have that over here. Anyway, so that's the Metta Sutta. Now we have the question suttas. Because I've been meditating on the breath for a number of years, my mind automatically goes to the breath when I sit and also when thoughts arise. This is not okay. If not, how do I retrain my mind? The habit is very strong. It doesn't matter. It does not matter what you are observing. It does matter how you are observing it. Remember? Make peace, be kind, be gentle. Whatever you're aware of. So you may see the Buddha come up. It's a beautiful Buddha with all the radiance. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle, don't get excited. You may see this devil come up with the horns and big googly eyes and teeth dripping with blood. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's all you need to do. So it doesn't matter what you're aware of. If the breath comes up, make peace, be kind, be gentle. Let it be. That's all you need to do. You can't control your mind. The mind throws these things up. What you can do is make peace, be kind, be gentle. And for those of you who think, where does this come from, this make peace, be kind, be gentle? Did Ajahn Brahm make it up? The Buddha made it up. Eightfold Path. Second factor of the Eightfold Path. Right intention, right thought. Who knows what that means? There are three samasankappas, three right thoughts. Nekama sankappa, avayapada sankappa, and ahimsaka sankappa. Nekama sankappa means renunciation. But what you're renouncing is, you know, your will, your control. That's what I mean by making peace. That's the first of the factors. The first of the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path. The first of the right thoughts or right intentions. The intention to make peace, to let go. The second is avayapada, which means non-ill will. And in Pali that means metta. They use avayapada as a synonym for metta. In other words, be kind. Open the door of your heart to this breath if it comes in. Open the door of your heart to this monster who comes in. Remember the demon in the Emperor's Palace? Welcome, thank you for coming. That is the right reaction. And if it's not the devil who comes into your room, it might be just somebody comes in late, clomping, 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 while you're just about to get into jhanas. If they come into the room making a big noise, welcome, thank you for coming to disturb me. So, you know, that's giving me metta, and also the gentleness. Ahimsaka, made famous by Gandhi, and his ahimsaka is non-violence. And it's amazing how many meditators do violence to themselves. My knee's hurting, doesn't matter. I'm gonna bear with the pain. That's actually doing violence to yourself. One of the monks of our tradition, and I grew up with him, he's over in Harnam, that's Ajahn Menindo. He decided to do the sitting through pain. And he had to have a double knee reconstruction. Both knees went. And that's violence to your body. So you don't do violence to your body. You don't do violence to your mind. You're gentle. So, make peace. Or let it go. That's the same thing. Make peace, be kind, be gentle. That's the second factor of the Eightfold Path. One of the most neglected factors of the Eightfold Path. That's why I try and bring it to your attention. So if the breath comes up, fine. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. And then everything goes okay. But that's it. The breath, I should be aware of something else. No, just keep it natural. But you make sure that you react with right thought or right intention. Just make peace, be kind, be gentle. What is the name of the monk you talked about this morning? Oh, I mean the stupid monk. That's a long time ago. I don't know. Who was it? But I know that this, I forget his name now, but anyway, that particular monk, you know, he could never do the chanting. Because, you know, he was just too simple a mind. He couldn't actually learn all the chanting. But what he did do, whenever he had to do a ceremony, he went into his samadhi and he recalled a past life when he was a monk many lives before. And then that particular life he could remember the chanting, and he actually channeled that so he could actually chant in public. This lifetime he couldn't remember anything. So that's how she managed it, so I was told. Dear Ajahn, what is the present moment? This is the present moment. So, okay, now this is a good question, because I shouldn't sort of make fun of this one. It amazes me that people have to ask that question. Because I've been asked that many, many times. What do you mean by the present moment? And it shows that in our society we live so much in the future and the past, or in fantasies and thoughts, that even the very idea of the present moment confuses us. What a sad state of affairs that is. And it's being in the present moment, being now, being here. So can you feel this pressure of your bottom against the seat right now? You experience that right now. It's like life as it happens, not reruns. Not sort of trailers for the movie coming next week. This is as it happens, live. So sometimes the present moment is very rare for us to be in, because we're always going off into the future, or we're always lingering on the past. So you can understand what the past is. You know, think about what happened this morning, early on in your life. Even just trying to work out what happened a moment ago. It's all to do with the past. And you know what the future is. You know, when you think, what am I going to do next? What's happening next? How long is this going to go on for? When's it going to get to my question? When can I go back? When can we finish? How many more days to go? What am I going to do when I leave here? You know what the future is. Now imagine that all the past has disappeared. And you're not thinking about the future. What's left? What's left is called the present moment. So after a while, in every of these stages of meditation, I say there's three levels. Number one, recognition. So in other words, you understand what present moment means. You recognize it. Same with silence. You understand what silence means. You understand what the breath means. You understand what nimittas mean. Because at first, sometimes, what is this? Is this a nimitta? Is this what you mean? So the first level is recognition. So you recognize, this is what we mean by the present moment. This is what we mean by silence. And once you have recognition, the next stage is familiarity. Now you're familiar, it's the old present moment again. You've been there so many times, you're familiar with it. And the last level is ease, comfort. Because it's the old present moment, you're at ease with it. In exactly the same way when you first came to this retreat center, you went into your room. First day you would not be at ease, because it's a new place. So first time, you know, sometimes the first time in this retreat centre, you don't know your way around. Because you've got to recognise where the toilets are, where the dining room is, where everything is. And after a few hours you can recognise everything, you get familiar with the place. Even now, I know some of you are treating your room like it's your own home. You know, it's your own place again. Your bed is familiar. Oh, I'm not in my own bed again. It's familiar, and once it's familiar, then you can relax and be at ease. And it's exactly the same when you have these different stages of meditation. The present moment, once you recognize it, this is the present moment. You understand what we're talking about. No past, no future. When all those two things have disappeared, and you're right in this moment with life as it's happening, it doesn't matter what you're aware of, it could be sound, feeling, a thought, but it's happening now. And you're aware of what's happening in this moment. That's present moment. You recognize that, you soon become familiar with it, which means you can be at ease with it. When you first are aware of the present moment, you're not you're not at ease with it. You wonder what the heck's going on, which means it doesn't last long. It means you still go off into the past or the future because you're in unfamiliar territory. But when you familiarize yourself with the present moment, afterwards you can be at ease with it, you can just leave it alone, and it stays. The same with silence. The old trick which I use, because many years ago, someone said, look, my mind can't be silent, it's always thinking, and I can't stop thinking. And I said, yes, you can. He said, no, I can't. He said, yes, you can. No, I can't. I'll prove it. And so we developed this little exercise. I said, as I'm talking, I want you not just to listen to my words, but listening to the reaction of my words inside your brain. Because as I'm talking, you will begin to notice some gaps between my words. In those spaces, between my words, what was going on in your head? That was silence. So I can prove that, yes, you can stop thinking, and that's what it's like. So after a while, you recognize what we mean by, there it was again, silence. And once you recognize it, then you can become familiar with it, which means you don't interfere with it, which means you're at ease in the silence. You don't need to disturb it, therefore you don't wander off. Then you got the breath. Again, sometimes people ask, what am I supposed to watch? Am I supposed to watch the tip of my nose? Do not watch the tip of your nose. Because if you do, this is what happens. You've got your eyes closed, but if I could peel those eyelids back, you'd be watching the tip of the nose and you'd be doing this. Doing this for half an hour, you're going to have a big headache. Because that's actually what you do when your eyes are closed. Whatever your mind watches, your eyes go there as well. So that is not what we mean by watching the breath. People have never watched the breath before. It's just so easy. They haven't had all these instructions before, which, you know, mess you around. I just ask them, close your eyes, breathe in and out 3 times. I don't tell them how to watch the breath. Just breathe in and out 3 times and open your eyes. They can all do that. And then I ask them, how did you know you were breathing in and breathing out? They all know they were breathing in and breathing out. They don't necessarily watch the tip of the nose, they just know. I'm breathing in, I'm breathing out. Exactly. Now that's what you watch in breath meditation. The feeling of the breath, wherever it happens to be. And once you recognize that that's the breath, oh, you're sweet. After a while you get so familiar with it, you can just relax. And the breath going in, breath going out, having a wonderful time, not disturbing anything. Just enjoying the breath because it's your best friend. You're so familiar with it. It's familiar with you. You don't sort of interfere with each other. You just hang out together. That's what happens. So you're familiar. And then, later on, you get nimitta. And beautiful light in the mind. That couldn't have been a light. It came up too early. Or I was still listening to things. I could still feel the body. I'm sure it was somebody turned on the lights in the room and some of these lights go right at me. That was not a nimitta. That was the light. And then you think, no, there's no lights on. Everything was dark. That was a nimitta. So at last you start to recognize these things. More experience you recognize them until you get so familiar with them, it's just the old nimitta. And when it's just the old nimitta, you're familiar with it, you don't interfere with it anymore. It's just an old friend. It was an old friend. You don't have to put any airs and graces when I see an old friend you've known for a long time. You don't need to sort of, you know, tense up and what are they here for? What do they want? It's just an old mate, come in and just what do you want? So you're totally relaxed with an old friend. And because you're totally relaxed with an old friend, you're at ease with them. So you're at ease with this nimitta, and that's why it stays a long time. In any of these states, if you tense up, these objects of meditation go. And the reason you tense up is because you're not at ease with them. So you're a bit unfamiliar with the nimitta, which means you interfere with it. It's just what happens. But with many experiences, you're so at ease with it, you recognize it, so at ease with it, it just stays. And when it gets really powerful, you ease with those as well, so you can just go straight into the jhanas. So recognition, familiarity, ease. The three levels at every stage of meditation. So sometimes you have to keep on experiencing it many, many times before you recognize it and become at ease with it. But one good thing is, after the meditation, just look back, reflect, so you get to know these states. And they're okay, you don't need to be afraid. Which means they can stay with you and last a long time. So it's a wonderful question. What is the present moment? Soon you'll recognize it. When the past, the present, when the future and the past have all gone, and you're not sort of fantasizing or dreaming. Life as it happens, that's called the present. May I know what is meditation object? Nothing. I thought samatha meditation is supposed to watch the breath. If without watching the breath I get lost, please advise. It doesn't matter if you get lost, as long as you make peace, be kind, be gentle with being lost. So anyway, what is a meditation object? I think I've already answered that. Now, it does not matter what your meditation object is. What it matters is how you are reacting to your meditation object. That's a great sort of insight in meditation, because it means you can meditate any old time. You don't have to have the breath in mind. You don't have to think, oh, I can't even find the breath, you know, because that means I can't meditate. No, just you're aware of something. What are you doing with this awareness? Are you making peace? Are you being kind? Are you being gentle? Because if you make peace, that's called samatha. You're tranquilizing things. If you are kind, that's metta meditation. You open the door of your heart. If you're gentle, you're being like a compassionate Buddha. So you are generating peace, you're generating metta, you're generating gentleness. And the result of that is you have huge amounts of peace, great kindness and love. And just such a gentle, refined person. So it doesn't really matter what you're watching. What is most important is how you're watching it. And you'll find if you follow those instructions, you are more concerned with how you're reacting to every moment rather than what it actually is. You'll find, as I said this morning, these stages go naturally. Now your body, now all the time disappears. You are in the present moment when you make peace, you're kind, you're gentle. You've just got no business in the future or the past if you're peaceful, you're kind and gentle. You are silent, there's nothing to say. You're making peace. Shh, calm down. Just like the voice stops outside, the voice inside stops. And because you're making peace, being kind, being gentle, your body relaxes, which means it disappears and just got the breath comes up quite naturally. And you're just watching this breath, you're not trying to sort of get it into jhana or control, you're just making peace, being kind to your breath, being gentle whilst you're breathing. And it settles down. It's samatha. But also you're getting insight. This thing actually happens, you see more into how this whole process works. So on the journey, you're not just calming things down, you're getting great degrees of experience, which is the stuff of insight. And so it comes to the beautiful breath, and the beautiful breath comes up. If you get excited, you're not making peace. If you get afraid, you know, you're having some ill will. So you're making peace, being kind, being gentle with a beautiful breath, and it gets even more beautiful, and it's wonderful. And then nimittas come up. Limiters! You're not making peace anymore. You've overreacted. So you make peace. You're kind to them. Limiters. You can come in if you want. But look, you know, if you're busy, you want to go and visit my best friend next, you know, just go visit them. That's fine. You know, I love you, limiters, no matter what you ever do. And with that sort of, you know, kindness and peace and gentleness to your limiters, the limiters say, she's the sort of person I want to hang out with. And they will stay with you for a long time. And that's actually how it works. Always make peace, be kind, be gentle. So thank you for that question, because that allowed me to actually to teach you what meditation really is. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu for this morning's talk on meditation. It fully explained everything I wanted to know. Unfortunately not for everybody, because there's many more questions left. Are there any way to prevent the body moving forward and backwards during meditation? Yes, there is. sit in one of the chairs and tie yourself up. No, sometimes that happens. Let it happen, because a lot of times, you know, you're not really moving. There's a stage in the meditation, and it's when the body starts to disappear, or just has, you know, kind of disappeared. And at that particular stage, before the nimittas came up, it's almost like pre-nimitta stage. That's when your perception can do weird and wonderful things. You can feel your body balloon out till it fills half the hole. You think you're rising up into the air. Or you think your body explodes, like Ajahn Chah with his little lungs over here, his heart of somewhere else. Or you can think your body is moving backwards and forwards. And it's not. This is just the perception of having fun. One of the first times that happened to me, just meditation getting very strong, this is over in the monastery in Thailand, I went past the washing area, and it was weird. I saw somebody's towel on the line, and the towel was jet black, as black as a lump of coal. And I thought, I've never in my life seen a black towel before. Yellows, pinks, usually whites, blues, but never a black towel. And it wasn't like a dirty, it was like jet black. And I just stared at it. What's going on here? I stared at it for about 2 or 3 minutes, and then it changed back to white. And I thought, wow, what's going on? Am I going crazy? It was a real experience. Now, it wasn't sort of, you don't take drugs in monasteries in Thailand. It was just my meditation was so strong, you could see a white towel as black. And you realize, why not? It's just perception adds this thing of whiteness onto it. And now my perception was actually being free, so I don't always need to see it as white. I can see it as black. And one of the other times, you're looking at the brick wall, and it started to melt like chocolate on a hot day. Wow, that's cool. You don't need to be afraid, because it's just your mind. It's actually almost challenging. This perception is so heavily conditioned. And now, all that conditioning, all that sort of, you know, hard sort of brainwashing, is now taken away, and your perception is going to see things in the weird and most wonderful ways. A lot of time when you think you're moving, you're not. Perfectly still. So a lot of times, if you think you're moving backwards and forwards, don't worry about it. It's just the perception starting to mess around. So it's not the body actually moving. It's just perception is just playing around with you. And when those things happen, enjoy it. It's weird and wonderful, and I love weird and wonderful things, you know, because monks, you know, there's so many things we can't do. And this is actually a bit of fun. It's like watching a movie, you know, just weird stuff. So I love that weird stuff. So it's a bit of entertainment for you. So when it happens, don't need to be afraid. You're not going crazy. I guarantee that. It's all going to be fine. Just have fun. And after a while, it all disappears. And then usually it gets so quiet, you get nimittas come up next. So it's really good stuff. On the topic of not striving, can you tell your own story to address, if there was no striving, how would the human race survive or improve? The usual stuff. I was hoping for something along the lines of Ajahn Chah's earthworm, a more dirt story. Look, why should the human race survive? We're like a cancer on this planet. You know, we've caused so much destruction to this planet. You know, there's too many of us and we keep on breeding. You know, somebody asked me this in the last retreat. You know, what about, what can Buddhist monks, or what can Buddhists do for the environment? And it's obvious what you should do for the environment. We need you to become monks and nuns so you don't have any more babies. Because overpopulation is the biggest problem. So I think anybody over 16 should be a monk or a nun, and that will solve the population problem. And then most environmental problems would be stopped. So when there'd be no striving, how the human race survive or improve? It would be thinned out. And when it thinned out, it'd have a much more wonderful time. So we always think of improvement, but has life really improved? Over the years which you've been alive? Is it really progress? It's always a wonderful question to ask. In certain areas we've had progress, in other areas it's got much worse. But because of human conceit and pride, it's just too devastating to think we've gone backwards. So we always perceive it as progress. Is it? Ajahn Chah's earthworm and more dirt story was there was an earthworm and he was burrowing through the ground and eating dirt. And he thought, actually, there's hundreds of other earthworms as well. We're all eating this earth. It means in a short time, the earth will be all eaten up. We'll have nothing more to eat. That'll be the end of us. And so the earthworm got very afraid. And that was the story. But look, you know, the earthworm can keep on eating earth for a long, long time. But that's the earthworm. As for us, maybe we are. We have maybe eaten up all the earth. Eaten up all the oil. Eaten up all of the water. Who knows? This might be the end of the world coming. So, you only got another 4 or 5 days left. You better meditate. Who knows, anyway. Anyway, that was the earthworm story. Next question. Well, I'm relaxed and comfortable now. The conditions are good. The temperature, noise, etc. all fine. My mind, however, quick as lightning, it goes thinking of all the things I decided not to think about. Almost as soon as I catch it out, it's off once again on another adventure. How do I best deal with this? First of all, now because everything is perfect here, you've got no one to complain about. That is really, really frustrating. Because if it was somebody making noise, it's not my fault, you know, if they're making too much noise, you know, if it was in a dormitory and the situations are not nice, the food is not good, the climate's not good, isn't it wonderful when you've got somebody to complain about? Now, it's so perfect, you know, it wasn't anything to complain about afterwards, it's always you. You were the problem, so don't blame anybody else. So, that's great insight. So it's me is the problem, not the teacher, don't blame me. So, thinking about all the things you decide to think about. And I wonder, why do I think about these things? And it's just your way of escaping from this present moment. A lot of times it's because we're afraid of silence. And again, this is an amazing thing to understand, that when people are silent, you first tell people, it's, you know, stop speaking to each other, and they find that very difficult. They feel so uncomfortable because they've never been there before. If you go to a very silent place, I remember Bodhinyana Monastery when we first opened it up, it was so quiet. We saw visitors come in. As soon as they went through the door, they raised their voice. They spoke louder. So what are they doing that for? And I realized they were afraid of the silence so much, they tried to destroy it by speaking loud. Now, of course, the only way to overcome that is, you know, just stop the thinking a little while, see the spaces between the thoughts, become familiar with silence. And when you become familiar with it, you like it so much, you just get at ease with it. So you don't need to escape anymore into thinking and fantasies. And a way which I've taught a number of people on this retreat to try and doing that, you're in a beautiful piece of nature. If you're thinking, just have a walk outside and listen to the sound of the birds. Or just, you know, feel the sensations in your body as you're walking, especially on the walking meditation path, because you find that you can't be listening to the sound of the birds and thinking at the same time. You can't be feeling the wind on your face and be thinking about, you know, what you're going to have for dinner. So the feelings in the body that actually bring you back to reality, they ground you. The sounds of nature, they ground you in the silence. So use that, if you're thinking, to actually to break through that whole continuity of thinking by getting something simple, peaceful, which brings you to the present moment and brings you to being passive rather than reactive at the sound of the birds or the feelings in the body. Or your cup of tea and you taste everything as the tea goes down your throat. Now that's a good way of stopping the worst part of thinking. And once you get used to the silence, you know, recognition, familiarity and ease, it's simple to be silent. And all that thinking, you think, just why did I keep getting into that? It's just a total waste of time. And it's just so tiring to think. It drives you crazy sometimes. You know, you really get into some of these obsessive thoughts, and you're not thinking those thoughts. Those thoughts are thinking you. And they just drive you crazy sometimes. So when you learn how to be silent, oh, you're just so lucky, you're so free. So persist on that, and there's a couple of ways of doing it, and then you find your mind is silent, and it loves it. My meditation has been more peaceful than ever the last few months, however. Why do they always say however? They start off so well, these questions. My meditation has been more peaceful than ever the last few months, however. Often when I start to get really peaceful, I suddenly find that I've dozed off. It doesn't seem to be due to sleep deficit, as I've rested up heaps here. How to stay awake to enjoy the fun? I can normally keep... See, I'm stopping talking over and just reading this. I can normally keep a perspective on the hindrances, but this one has me by... Has me by the round things. So if you've got sloth on top, again, it is natural. So just, the best thing to do is, just if you're sloth on top, just be with the sloth on top and let it happen. And if you let it happen, it soon disappears. But if you fight it and get upset about it, it means that you just make it worse. But it's not nature. Just let it happen. Be at peace with it. And then it will just disappear. And after a while, it just disappears anyway. So you need to get sort of making peace, being kind, being gentle. Just you find as the retreat goes by, the sloth on top gets less and less and less. And you get surprised you don't sleep so much. You get up early, not because you know you set your alarm. You just wake up early. And it's, I feel fine, so let's meditate. And it's natural because the energies start to build up. So don't let the sloth on top get you by those round things. Just let them be, so they just can't catch you anywhere. So you're this person, they try and grab you, but you really are like a ball. Just one single ball, and they can't catch you. There's no handle on you to grab you, because you just let it go. Not a question apropos. Why in the stool a uniform yellow-brown despite the many... where is the stool? Okay. This is one of those funny questions. Why is the stool, you know, the feces, a uniform yellow-brown despite the many hued food we eat? This is because during the process of food digestion, urobilin, a pigment secreted by the liver and stored in the gallbladder, is later converted to stercobilin in the colon, large bowel, which stains the feces and gives it that delightful golden yellow, nut brown, chocolatey colour. Thank you for that. You learn something every day. But look, where does that pigment come from, the urobilin and stercobilin? It must come from the food anyway. Everything comes from the food, so that's where it comes from. So it really is the food anyway. So actually you're missing the point here, because even that pigment, which is brown, that came from the, you know, the white rice and the, you know, the green peas. So, you know, it's just, you're missing the point there. You know, everything goes in different colours and comes out brown. So where did those colours come from? Oh, okay. This is one of those joke questions. Ajahn, is it true that if I do meditation, my sex drive will decrease? I'm a young man. Please don't say it will disappear and I will be a zombie. No, you won't be a zombie. You'll be a monk. Look, your sex drive, you're driving without a license, sex drive. So you're getting caught by the police. And especially when you drive on the wrong side of the road. Whenever you drive, you're going to have crashes. So it's a wonderful thing, the sex drive. You know, have you really got a license? Have you been training? You know, are you competent to be on the roads? Most of you ain't. So that's why it's best, especially not to drive at night. So yes, when you do meditation, it does decrease. Isn't that a wonderful thing? You know, just number one, you save so much on clothing. I mean, how much does sex cost? You know, all fashion, you know, to get sex, it costs a huge amount of money, the dresses and the clothes and everything else. And just everything else you have to do, nice hair, how much does it cost, you know, to get sort of go to the hairdressers? And you know, you've got to go out, and they're always expensive places, you know, the nightclubs. They cost a fortune to go to. And what do you do that for? So, you know, you can save a lot of money. By coming to this meditation, your sex drive disappears. And what happens, you know, if you do have sex, you're in big trouble. Babies, rings, 20-year, 30-year prison terms when you're married. That's what it's like. So, and it all started because of sex drives. How much suffering has it caused you? You know, because that's what happens when you get married. You've got all these wonderful jokes about marriage. About, you know, the person once they were married, they said, I never knew what happiness was until I got married. And then it was too late. When I was going out with my sweetheart, we'd always held hands in love. I've been married 20 years now and I still hold hands with my wife out of self-defense. Why are you laughing? I know why you're laughing, because it's true. It all comes from your sex drive. So isn't it wonderful? It's already got you into so much trouble. And then you have kids. And once you have kids, that's another prison term. 17, 18, 19. Do you know how much they cost? It's a huge amount of money how much your kids cost. And they cause you so much trouble, they drive you insane sometimes. So I always tell people, if you do get married, get a cat, get a dog, get a rabbit. It costs much less. And the dog is always pleased to see you. When you come home, your wife, your husband, sometimes, oh, no, 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 no. And a rabbit, you can always stroke the rabbit. You know, sometimes your wife, no, I've got a headache, leave me alone. Rabbits never have headaches. So if you get, I get a rabbit, for goodness sake. I'm a young man, please don't say it will disappear. You're not a young man. Oh, how old is old? Now, I had a youth group years ago, and that was a question I had to the youth group, in the Buddhist group, say, how old is old? I know about, you know, 10, 11-year-olds. And so that was very difficult. So I said, well, no, that's about 40. Yeah, that's ancient, 40. 20? Yeah, it's getting there. 25? Yeah, they're just about middle. 30, they're old. So you're all old. Most, well, many of you. And that's actually biologically true, because apparently the neurons in your brain, I think, they stop making new ones after 25, so I was told. So you're all going downhill. Many of you are way down, halfway down the slope. So when it disappears, you won't be a zombie. You'll be free. No sex drive, totally free from all this stuff which you see. So yeah, stick around with me and you'll be fine. Dear Ajahn, is the silence a hissing noise in the background where no thoughts are present? No, that's, you know, the kettle, that must be breathing, I don't know. No, the silence is not the sound outside, it's the sound inside. It's your reaction to things. In other words, you're not giving things a name. Again, it's the difference between thinking, what a beautiful sunset, and actually seeing it. The difference between tasting the tea and thinking, this is nice. That's what silence means. It means being in reality rather than being in the world of thought. The Buddha said, it is by rare opportunity that one is introduced to a true spiritual teacher. It's difficult to be one in knowledge and practice. So, I can see that we think it is enough to hear and understand your daily teachings, when in fact it is only when we experience and practice what you teach that it sticks. Can you comment, teacher? Yeah, look, how many times have you been coming to this retreat? I keep on telling you the same things. So it's when you experience and practice it that it sticks. So it's true. You can hear these things and hear them many, 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 many times. But it's actually the experience. That's why one of Ajahn Chah's favourite teachings was, what is it, the ladle and the soup. I think it's from the Buddha. The ladle and the soup. The ladle has to be put into the soup before it can experience the taste of the soup. In other words, you have to taste the soup until you know what it's like. Because everybody might say, oh, this is wonderful soup. But if you haven't tasted it, how do you know? You can think about it. Somebody asked me to give in the last retreat my simile of the professor and the menu. One of my great similes. In Perth, did I say this on this retreat? Yes, I did already. Okay, this retreat. Okay, so you know that one. So like eating the menu is different than eating the food. So remember, that's, you can study these teachings, you can do a PhD on them, you can translate these teachings into so many different languages, but that's not the point. It is to experience and practice, and then it sticks because you understand what we're talking to. So I might say, peace. 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 Listen afterwards, after the word finishes. Peace. 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 After the word finishes, if you're fortunate and pay attention, you can understand what the word is pointing to. The mind goes in the direction and experiences peace. Peace. That's the whole point of words, to point you in a direction so you can actually go there and experience what the word is supposed to describe. But too often that one word follows after another and your poor mind doesn't have a chance to experience what the word is pointing to. So all those teachings, make peace. Be kind. Be gentle. Give yourself a time and the mind will practice it. And you experience, and it's wonderful. It's actually not that hard. Thank you very much for being my biggest Kalyana Mitra. What do you mean biggest? Am I fat? Call me the biggest Kalyana Mitra. I'm not fat, I'm just happy. I am valuing every moment of my presence in Perth in Jhana Grove Retreat Centre in peace. Ajahn, can I fall asleep while I'm in the third stage, silent present moment awareness of the breath? You're allowed to fall asleep at any time. Just let the sleep come and see what happens. So don't be afraid of sleep. And then if you're afraid of sleep, it will keep coming. If you're not afraid of it, it will disappear. How do I gain wisdom to make wise choices? So often I regret words and actions made. Live in the present moment. So you make your choices and forget about it. So there's no regrets when you don't remember the past. Look, already, you know, I didn't remember that I told that story about the professor and the menu. So it's great when you live in the present moment. You don't know what you said last week. Oh, so you've got no regrets. And people blame you and say, did I say that? I don't know, I forgot. So regret words and actions made. When you regret, number one, you go back into the past. And when you go back into the past, do you really know what you did? Because when you go back in the past, we've got a very biased memory. So we remember only what we want to recall. And much of what happened, we actually push out of our memory. And also, you know, if it's something we really, really like, we actually embellish it. And our mind is so devious, you just cannot trust the past at all. What you think happened, probably didn't happen. And I got a paper in my room over the road in the monastery. This psychologist in the United States was about to retire, and he was cleaning out his papers and found out this results of a survey he did at the very beginning of his career when he was a young psychologist. He'd interviewed all these kids in school and asked them about many questions like your home life, do you love your mother more than your father or your father more than your mother, or neither of them. I remember one of the questions was, how did your parents discipline you? Do they send you to the room? Do they spank you? Do they sort of do other punishments take away your allowance? And so he had all these hard evidence of actually kids' life. And that was about 30 years ago. And he thought, as one of his last research projects, he'd try and find as many of children as possible and give them the same survey and see if what they remember of their childhood matched the record of what they said at the time. And he wrote this paper because it was almost totally different. Their memory of ordinary things. Now, how did your parents punish you? Well, they said, they just sent me to my room. No, they said, no, they spanked me. Those who said at the time they spanked me, no, they never spanked me. It was totally opposite. And the whole purpose of that research was to show how unreliable our memory is. So when you make a decision, I don't know why I made that decision. It's gone now. I don't remember. So you just let it go. And anyway, even if you do remember exactly, you can't change it. So when you made a decision, you leave it go. You never look back. Don't do hindsight. If you do hindsight, it just confuses you enormously. Oh, I should have done something else. No, you shouldn't have done something else. Now the situations have changed, but at that time that was the only thing you could have done. So you did it. So what we should be doing, instead of looking backwards, we look in the present moment. Okay, here we are. Now what can I do with this? I can't change it, but I can always make peace, be kind, be gentle. I can always make fertilizer out of shit. There's always something I can do with what I've got. So it's when you made a decision, doesn't matter which way it is, you make it work. And that's actually how I work these days, because I have to make decisions. When I make decisions, get a bit of information, and I usually make decisions quite quickly. Okay, we'll do it this way. Because I know it doesn't really matter if you turn left or you turn right, it's still the same journey. Whether you go on the left road or the right road, it's just how you're walking. It's not the sort of the different road, it's how you travel. That's the only important thing. So whichever road you travel in life, it's not the road, but how you walk is a secret of happiness. So whichever path you travel, the path of a monk or the path of a stupid sex addict, it's how you travel that road is the trick. So no regrets. Aha, here we go, nice one. Ajahn, you stated the Buddha committed suicide. I never heard this statement before. There we go. You learn something new every day. I'm a born Buddhist and practice Buddhism for 50 years or more. Learn Buddhism A to Z. It is sad and disappointing to hear above from a good monk like you. Why? Why is that sad? Because a lot of times when a religion just becomes a set of accepted doctrines, it's got no life anymore. It means we just believe and we don't think. And would the Buddha want you to do that? So, if Buddha wanted to commit suicide when he stayed so long, why did he go through 6 years of hard life? Those 6 years of hard life was when he was a bodhisattva. He wasn't enlightened. Now, it's interesting. In the suttas, it always says unenlightened bodhisattva. Those two words always go together. Anabhisambuddho bodhisattva. So, when he was doing those hard practices, he was not wise. He was stupid. He admits that. And that's why he said, don't go that path. So the reason why the Buddha gave up the will to live, which is a suicide, was because he'd done his job, everything had been done, so there was no much point anymore. So he let go. Now to know the mind of an arahat, know the mind, there's nothing more to do. Why carry on? Now, the interesting part of that thing about suicide, which I stated later yesterday, and one of the reasons I say this, and one I talk about euthanasia, is because people have, it's almost a pathological fear of death. It's that fear of death stops us looking at suicide or euthanasia in a logical, compassionate way. Death is a taboo. He said, a Buddha, a spiritual being, how can you do that, commit suicide? It's wrong, because suicide, death is a taboo. And this is actually why insight has to overcome those wrong ways of thinking. What's wrong with death? You've done it many, many times. And so death in many cultures is regarded in such an obsessive and negative way that has created so much pain and fear in all of our communities. Death is looked upon as a failure, in the same way that sickness is looked upon as a failure. And you feel sort of sense of humiliated by sicknesses. Why old age is considered with a huge amount of negativity. Wouldn't it be a wonderful society when sickness, old age and death is seen for what it truly is? Part of life. And accept it. Don't be afraid of it. When you start to accept death and look upon it in a different way, things like euthanasia and suicide are not these terrible, terrible, the worst things which could possibly happen. It's not whether you die or you don't die. It's not whether you euthanize or you don't euthanize, or suicide or you don't suicide. It's how you do it. If you're done with making peace, being kind, being gentle, then it's good karma. I'm saying that quite carefully, because this is a radical statement. Good karma is not the act, but whether it's done with kindness, with compassion, with no greed, with no ill will, without any defilements. That is defined as good karma by the Buddha. So, it doesn't matter what you do, it's how you do it. Whether it's really coming from compassion, whether it's coming from ill will, whether it's coming from stupidity, or whether it's coming from the opposites of wisdom. Very good question. Good day, Bhante. Regards putting a name on a stick and throwing it away. Please remind our visitors to Down Under that there's a big difference between a stick and a boomerang. Boomerangs always come back to the thrower. They will come back when you leave. You can throw your husband away here, but he'll be there for you afterwards. But at least you have time off. You have a holiday. You're free for a while. So don't make use of this. You know, don't bring, whenever you go on a holidays, don't bring your mobile phone with you. Otherwise the boss will keep contacting you. You know, when you're here, just turn it off. You know, you can do that. The boss said, I'm trying to contact you. Yes, but I was in meditation retreat. It was a spiritual retreat. And then, okay. Whenever I come on retreats and get into practicing, lay life seems quite pointless. Yeah, I agree. What do you do it for? We're crazy. When you go to work every Monday morning and you never get enough money, and you really work hard, you always get blamed and criticized because it's not good enough. You know, and in the end, you know, just you're going to get sort of the sack, or you're going to get redundancy payment. They're going to get rid of you in the end. There's younger people coming behind you who cost much less money and are smarter than you. So be careful. You know, the people aren't employing you out of loving kindness. They're just exploiting you. Your salary, the money they pay you, is a bribe to make you do things you'd rather not do. If you enjoyed your work, who would need to pay you? So that lay life, come on, become monks, become nuns. Look, we've done all the hard work, we've got set up the monasteries, we've set up the nunneries, I've ordained bhikkhunis, so you can actually become a bhikkhuni now. It's one of the only places in the world. It's open. So, hear your husband, just tell him, darling, I've become a nun. Husband, I'm sorry about that, but you know, So, but when I get out again, I get caught up in things and can feel my mind going downhill. And then really crave to go on retreat again. I think generally my practice is improving, but it goes up and down like this, going in and out of retreats. Can you please comment on this? Yes, ordained. It's actually, no, it's being serious. Just, I can't understand why more people aren't lining up to become monks and nuns. You know, you have enough insight. What a beautiful lifestyle it is. One of the reasons I became a monk when I was looking for a career in life, and you know, I just was, because I was a scientist, I stood back and reflected, what do I want to do in life? And for me it was, I had to satisfy two criteria, two goals. One was my own happiness. You've got to be happy with whatever you do. That was important. I couldn't do a job which was maybe meaningful, but which made me miserable. And the other thing, my job had to be able to serve others. It had to be not just meaningful for me, but it had to make a contribution. Now look what I'm doing now. I'm having a great time as a monk. You know, you've been around me, I'm a happy monk, I have a great time. And I'm serving so many people. And you know that you get this fulfillment as a monk. People come up and tell you, if it wasn't for you, I'd kill myself. You know, you saved my family. You saved my marriage. You saved my life. I don't know how many hundreds of people, I'm not exaggerating, have told me that. Imagine what that does to you when someone comes up and says, what you have done for them. That's job fulfillment. Huge. That could be you. Sign up, the forms at the back. Number two, if your son or your daughter wants to become a monk, don't just say, oh no, I want you to get married, no, I want you to sort of, you know, have kids, I want grandkids, no, I want you to, look, shut up. If you stop your child from becoming a monk or a nun, that's one of the worst bad karmas you could possibly do, and that's no joke. So if your child comes up and says you want to become a monk or nun, and you stop them doing this amazing good karma and service, you're in big trouble. So encourage them. And you get lots of benefits out of it. So there we go. You mentioned that the Digha Nikaya are authentic words of the Buddha. In one of the texts it mentions the marks of a great man, and one of them describes how the Buddha can use his tongue and touch either side of his earlobes. I find this hard to believe. I can't even touch my own nose with my own tongue. Please comment. Not all of the Digha Nikaya is authentic, and that's sort of, many people think that must be made up afterwards, because you know, if that was the case, the Buddha would be a freak. I've been really freaky. You know, long earlobes, he had all these marks on his feet and other sort of stuff. I won't tell you about, you know, what was between his legs. If you read that, that does not make any sense at all. And you know that that's a common result of what's called actually hagiography. You know, a person's a great person. And they actually add all these other attributes onto them, just you know, because the disciples just want their teacher to be the best. And if another teacher says, I mean, he's got marks on his feet, then my teacher has to have marks on the feet as well. And that's called hagiography, as we embellish and enhance sort of, you know, our teacher and their reputation. And it's exaggeration. So many people say, well, whenever you look at these teachings that are in the suttas, first of all, you know the Abhidharma, that must have been later. And you look at inside the suttas, you know that some of those must have been later. And that's probably one of them, because it doesn't make any sense. And it's inconsistent, because there were many cases. There's one case when the Buddha was traveling by himself and he stayed the night, actually he was going to stay the night in a potter's shed, but another monk was staying there. And so, you know, he asked permission of the other monk, do you mind if I stay here as well? There's plenty of room for both of us. And of course, you know, the Buddha started meditating, so the monk started meditating. And it's one of those cases, like in the evening here, you know, you won't go to bed because someone else is meditating as well, you want to beat them. So these two were meditating all night, the Buddha and sort of this monk. And the monk afterwards said, "You're a very good meditator." And the Buddha said, "Oh, so are you." And the Buddha said, "Now, who's your teacher?" And this monk said, "Oh, the Buddha's my teacher. Have you ever met the Buddha?" "No, I'm actually going to see him." He said, "I'm the Buddha." "Ah! You mean I've been staying with my teacher all night?" And there's a wonderful little story there, because what it tells us, that there was an ordinary monk, and he stayed the night with the Buddha, meditating together, and he didn't recognize him. Now, if he really did have long ears, and you would recognize him straight away. It'd be a dead giveaway. So that actually shows that the Buddha, he may have been a special person, but not that weird that, you know, that he would stand out from the crowd. And the other one was when, towards the Buddha's end of the Buddha's life, King Ajatasattu went to visit the Buddha for the first time in the Chaita Grove. He had to ask his minister, who was actually Jivaka, the doctor. He said, "Which one is the Buddha?" He said, "It's the one in the middle pillar facing the east. That's the Buddha." And again, if the Buddha was really strange, then the king would not need to ask that question. So we know we use internal evidence to see there's an inconsistency there. And because of that, we realize that this is just hagiography. Things which are added. And it's not important anyway. Does that really sort of increase your faith if the Buddha had a long tongue? Does that really help your meditation? Does that give you much wisdom? So basically it doesn't really matter. How to let go of inner speech. Inner speech became my second nature in my meditation. I know that it's not advisable in deep meditation. Even in shallow meditation it's not advisable, let alone deep meditation. So just what you can do, we have these mantras which people use. You know that in the Thai tradition, have a mantra, you say along with the breath, Buddho, Buddho, Buddho. So you breathe in, you say Buddho, breathe out, Buddho, Buddho, along with the breath. When you're doing the walking meditation, I've already taught you one mantra, "I will die, that's for sure." But for the Westerners, or those who have been influenced by the West, I have got my special mantra, which you say with your breath. As you breathe in, you recite to yourself, "Shut." As you breathe out, "Up." "Shut." "Up." "Shut." "Up." And after about 10 minutes of that, you might actually do it. You might shut up. It'll take yourself a long time. But that inner speech, it is a problem, but I've already told you many techniques there. One of those techniques, listen to the sound of the nature, the birds, feeling the body, because that actually does tend to stop you. Or listen to the space between the words. The Buddha said, "What I teach you is like the leaves in my hand, enough to gain liberation. What I know is like the leaves in this forest." This is one of the sayings there. One would think that to have such omniscience, the training would certainly take a long, long time. Would this not imply a greater depth of patience, endurance, wisdom, and compassion? Would this not be where the paramis come in? No, the meaning was, he said, look, everything which is necessary, which is useful to teach you how to become enlightened, he said, I've taught you. And all the other stuff, it's useful, it's interesting things, just like, why the water is salty, and just how high the peaks are, and just where the brown comes in your feces, which we learned tonight. I mean, that's interesting, but it's not really necessary to get you peaceful in meditation. And that's what the Buddha meant. There's so much other stuff he knew about the world, but all the important stuff he taught, and that's the most important part of that Samsapa leaf story. He said, but what I've taught you, everything which is necessary, I've taught you, so you don't need anything more than that. So you don't need more. So the Buddha was kind, just teaching you enough for you to do the job. Thank you for leading us out of rebirth. Wonderful teachings. You are an inspiring example, the result of practice. Yes, I deserve that. I keep on saying that because when somebody praises you, accept it. When somebody criticizes you, it's a great way to be happy. Now, what should you do when somebody criticizes you? Remember Ajahn Chah's story. If someone calls you a dog, look at your bottom, see if you've got a tail. If you ain't got a tail, you're not a dog, end of problem. Wonderful teaching that. So you're not just ignoring people, you're actually looking. Now, do I deserve that criticism? And if you do, oh, okay. Woof, 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 woof. I'm a dog. But if you don't, then forget it. As a Buddhist leader, if you continue to talk about euthanasia and suicide, it will damage the image of the faith of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. Will it? You know, one of the things which, you know, even a job as a Buddhist leader in Australia is to make Buddhism relevant and to end a lot of suffering in our world. And I think it's one of the things is that Buddhists should be logical, be compassionate, and see things from the suttas and the word of the Buddha from insight. And actually that doing things like that will not damage the image and the faith of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. It was actually would increase people's faith and understanding. Too many religions in our world, people are going against them because they are irrelevant to their daily lives. They don't make sense anymore. You know, like, for example, the Catholics, they don't use condoms. You know, even in Catholic countries, everyone, you know, uses those. It doesn't make any sense. Or people saying that, you know, that you should do away with the gay and lesbian community. People might say that, but most people respect the gay and lesbian community and they want those people to be given freedom. So a lot of religions are totally out of step with modern people. And what religion should be doing is advancing the peace and harmony and the happiness of people. They should be relevant. And there's too many Buddhists that are irrelevant. I know that during that global conference on Buddhism which we held here in Perth, was about how long ago was that? 4, 5, 6 years ago? 4 years ago. Wow, that's 4 years ago, pretty quickly. But anyway, so we held this global conference and, you know, I did managing most of it. I was chosen, the main title was Confronting the Controversies. So instead of hiding the controversies, let's bring them up and discuss them. And one of them was on euthanasia. And so I invited some monks, and I was so disappointed. The monks just went behind sort of what they thought the Buddha said. The Buddha said this, the Buddha said that. We all know that. What do you think? Confront the problem there. Is it compassion? And many people, like myself, who are on the coalface, I do go and visit the ICU unit. I do go and visit people who are dying. Many times, you've been with people, like one fellow, one of the old Buddhists, one of the founders of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, Don Clark, dying of lung cancer, and said to me, "Can't you take me out the back and shoot me?" In an Australian hospital with the best care, that's how much suffering he was having. I remember another guy dying of MS. How long do I have to bear this? Now, when you've been with people, you've got a compassionate heart, and you hear this many, many times. There's a problem there. Recently, just over a year ago, I went to see my mother, who has a profound dementia, so she doesn't recognize me. Being in this unit with about 50 women with dementia, and 50 women and men with dementia, my mother was quite content. But there was about two ladies I saw there who were in terror. And it's the first time I've been in a dementia ward, and I'm sensitive enough to actually pick these things up. And they were totally afraid, terrified. And it didn't take me long to understand why. Because sometimes I travel around and I wake up in the morning in some hotel or some piece of this person's house in another side of the world, and I wake up, where the hell am I? Imagine you wake up every second of your life not knowing where you are and who you're with. Imagine that. You've got no reference point at all. You're totally at sea without any anchor. That's terror. And no drug can actually take that terror away. That is incredible pain and suffering. then there must be some compassionate way to do something about that. And many people understand that, because these days people have seen that themselves. And so when I wrote that, many, many people came out of the woodwork, thank you, Attenborough, for showing some leadership. Of course, the argument never actually managed to get a bill passed in our parliament, because still Australia is very afraid of death. It's the only reason why, when it sort of gets a bit more mature and can accept death as part of life and not think it's the worst possible outcome and everything is okay as long as you keep people alive, then maybe we can get compassion. Well, I think it's making Buddhism more relevant. At least we're talking about it, rather than just hiding behind dogma like some fundamentalists. We're supposed to think about things. Anyway, there we go. In the chanting, who are the four pairs of people? The four pairs of people are the stream winner and the one on the path of being a stream winner. The once returner and the one on the path of being a once returner. The non-returner and one on the path of being a non-returner. And the enlightened one and the one on the path to being enlightened. Those are the four pairs. I'll talk about that sometime later. What does the Metta Sutta mean by able and upright? Upright means you're not laying down. And able means you're not disabled, I suppose. Okay. No, it just means like upright means, it actually the word is uttu. It doesn't actually literally mean straight. It means, you know, you're like morally strong. And able means, you know, you are skillful. How can I stop being a control freak with my breath, watching fearfully like a tyrannical boss over its every more when I get a moment's peace such that it loses its presentness quickly by trying to be less of a control freak in everything else you do in life? So when you go for your lunch, just eat things which you don't like. And let somebody else go in front of you. And there's only one carrot left. You take it. So it'll be a bit less worried about, you know, what goes into your tummy. Be a little less worried about what time you wake up in the morning. Throw away your clock. Or just for the rest of the retreat, put it in the drawer and don't take it out. So that way you're not so afraid. The reason why people are control freaks is because of fear. To overcome that fear, make mistakes and realize it doesn't matter. So you don't make it on time for the morning meeting. So what? I'm not going to punish you. I'm not going to criticize you. So what? You know, you're late for breakfast and, you know, you've got the crumbs and you can't have a full breakfast. So what? You won't die. You know, so what? You fall asleep and fall off the chair. You know, so what? You won't break any bones. This is quite soft, this bamboo. And there's all these cushions all over the place. You know, that you've got a very good chance of landing on a cushion or landing on the person in front of you. So you're going to be safe. So don't have any fear, because all control comes from fear. And it's because we're such fearful people, fearful of what other people think of us. No one is thinking about you in this retreat. They're all thinking about themselves. So you can do whatever you want. Fear of failure. Isn't it a wonderful thing to fail? And realize it's okay to fail. That's one of the great experiences. I remember this, one of the monks in Thailand, he had a friend at school who was winning all these races, like long distance runner. And people were actually thinking, this is like a champion in the making. He was winning all these school races and inter-school races, and he'd win everything. And they thought, you know, he's going to maybe make the Olympic Games team, and maybe win a gold medal. It was just incredible. Then one day he lost. He never won again. And so my mate asked him, said, what happened? He said, I finally figured out I didn't need to win. That's a wonderful statement. I finally figured out I didn't need to win. And all his pain and suffering, he was kidding himself running so hard. It was just so much suffering. He didn't get a gold medal, but he was so happy. Isn't it wonderful to realize you don't need to win? Oh, what a relief. You don't need to be the best. Oh, what a relief. You don't need to succeed. Just be yourself, and that's success. That's great when you realise that, and that means that you can actually, you're not a control freak anymore. It's all about being enlightened. Just open the door of your heart to who you are right now. With all your stupidity, with all my bad jokes, with all my sort of passion about controversial things like suicide and euthanasia and stuff like that. That's just who I am, so you may not like it, but that's tough. That's who I am, so. When you actually just, you don't want to succeed, you're just who you are. Life is so much easier. Because when you succeed, you can never actually get to the top, and it's just so hard. Just let other stupid people get to the top. You know, just, your job is just to be happy. So there we go. That's how you learn how to just be with your breath, and you're not a control freak. Investigate your fear. And just, what am I afraid of anyway? Come on, get real. Now, a few questions, feel free to choose. Thank you. What do you mean, feel free to choose? If you choose, you're not free. So I didn't choose any. I did a whole lot, you see. No choice, and then you're free. So give up all this choosing and controlling what you're going to do. So there we go. Now that's the questions for tonight. Have I answered all your questions? No, there's going to be some more coming tomorrow night. When will there be an end of all your questions? When your mind stops moving. When your mind is still. There all your questions are answered. They ask questions, the answer to the question why. You know the answer was there's nothing. That's the greatest question. And the biggest answer, there's nothing. So all the paper just disappears. No more paper, no more questions, no more thought. Freedom at last. To realize there are no answers because there are no questions. Bliss. So have a great night. And see you in the morning if you're still alive. And one thing about suicide and euthanasia, please don't do it on this retreat. When you get home, whatever you want, but please not here. Okay.